I heard this interchange once. Little boy says to his father, "Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic." And Daddy responded, "Son, you cannot do both." And I think the work of the steps has an awful lot to do with growing up, coming into a maturity, into an adulthood, spiritually and emotionally, mentally, thinking like adults, no longer reacting and overreacting like some very unhappy, spoiled children. When I started going to some Al-Anon because I was in pain, one of the women who mentored me by tape, by cassette tape, was Blanche from Salida, Texas. And Blanche died in 2000, much too early, in a freak accident. But I was given one of her tapes, and Blanche was an English teacher, and she was from northern Florida, and then married a Texan, went to Baylor, spent her years in Texas, and became as crazy as you can be married to an alcoholic. Full of secrets, full of control, full of fear. You know, someone asked about untreated Al-Anonism. Control, fear, anxiety, rage, exhaustion, grief. So she did something. Her father was a bad drunk, and she did something that a lot of people do. Claudia Black says, "It will never happen to me. I will never become like that." Blanche said, "I will never marry an alcoholic." So at Baylor, which is kind of like a big Baptist convent, not a lot of drinking happens on the campus of Baylor University. And she found this handsome boy there, and they married. And he didn't have a drink until they were married a couple years. He had never had a drink in his life. And if she had met a boy who was drinking, she just would never talk to him again. And you do that Al-Anon sniff test, that you hug him and go, you know, you smell. I've done that with a couple of sponsees. You just kind of sniff in. And I will confess to you that if I'm emotionally involved with you on any level, I go into denial. We had a fellow staying with us for a while in Oakland, and he was falling down drunk, and I didn't even notice. You need a meeting. That's what you need. And I drove him to a meeting, and I never noticed. He was full of booze. And I dropped him off at the meeting and came back to my house, and a couple of people who were not tied up in his crazy I said, "Why are you bringing him? He's drunk, Tom." I said, "He is." Well, I could not have been more shocked. So one of the things that seems to be operative is if I have an emotional relationship with you, I do go blind. There's stuff I don't see. And it also seems to be a rule, if you're dealing with family members, there's very little you can do. Parents can't help their kids. Now, that's not fair. But parents can't help their kids. Parents can help someone else's kids. This was true even when I was growing up. I found my own parents impossible for 100 different reasons. But parents of my friends I could talk to about anything, all the great things. But to my own parents, there was nothing to say. I was quite surprised years later to find out that some of my friends went and talked to my father about stuff. I said, "Well, what did he have to say?" You know, I was just flabbergasted that that man had anything to say to anybody. But if it's not your kid, you can deal with it. And the people who do any kind of work with Alateen are doing great work. Because kids need to have some safe adults to talk to who aren't crazy and who are safe. I met one of my pals is a Tom and Joan. They're a couple on the California coast, and they've been married almost 60 years now, I think. But Joan, she wasn't going to marry any boy that drank either. And she did that sniffing test, and she observed, and then she met Tom, and he was really cute and funny, and they got married. And he didn't smell of alcohol. She found out a few years later that the reason he didn't smell of alcohol was he was using heroin. And Al-Anon has saved her life, and it saved his more than once. Yeah. Anger becomes part of the Al-Anon thing. I get mad. I get mad when I'm surrounded by fools. So you can imagine what it's like in some AA meetings. You just get mad. And I have to learn a couple of adult principles. And one of the adult principles is live and let live. Live and let live. And that means you get to do stuff, including making mistakes. And I get to do stuff, including making mistakes. Live and let live. Blanche, in the tape I must have listened to 20 or 30 times, said growing up in northern Florida, she learned things that just were not true. And one of the things she learned as a little girl was what you don't know can't hurt you. And she said, listen, what I did not know about alcoholism almost killed 4 people. And one of the things she had to do as her husband got into recovery was learn about this disease. Ignorance is not bliss. And being able to talk about it without hype and without scare tactics and without a lot of other stuff is a great help. Out in California, they used to have people come into the schools to try to scare kids. Kids don't scare. Alcoholics don't scare. But sharing information is real helpful. And I find the programs, AA, Al-Anon, the other 12-step programs, we are friends, companions, and allies. We are not the enemy, and we are not the opposition. But learning how to be friends and companions and allies is a lot of grown-up stuff. Blanche also learned as a little girl, God helps those who help themselves. And she said, that's not true, you know. God helps those who ask. And what I need to do is remember to ask. I don't always do that. There's some stuff in me that tells me what I should do is, first of all, don't ask for help. You should be able to figure this out by yourself. If there's difficulties, keep it to yourself. Don't worry other people. And try harder. All of those will kill you. And in recovery, it is a great gift to be able to know what's going on, know what you know what's going on, being able to talk about it simply without blaming a lot of people. And asking for help, asking God for help, asking other people for help, remembering to breathe and to walk through things. Blanche said, in Al-Anon, we learn how to keep our sails out of other people's wind. I like that image a lot. Because I can get very much caught up in other people's stuff. And a lot of stuff is none of my business. We use this in AA. It's also used a lot in Al-Anon. Halt! Don't get too hungry. Don't get too angry. Don't get too lonely. Don't get too tired. When I was in my 40s, I said, well, that's a very important thing, and I'll keep an eye on it. And if I was too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired, I'd think about it, which is my first choice about anything. Think about it. Let me go to my room by myself and think about it. And I think for a while I believed that if I was too hungry, I could handle that. That's not a problem yet. Too hungry, too angry, okay, that's getting more complicated, but I can handle that. Hungry, angry, lonely, we're getting into difficulty. If all four of them are operating, I need to take action. And in my 50s and 60s, what I'm very aware of is any one of them makes me dangerous and stupid. And some of the most spiritual work I do in the course of a day is paying attention to the too hungry, too angry, too lonely, too tired. And they sneak up, catch me by surprise. Halt. I also heard this at an Al-Anon meeting, WAIT, or why am I talking? And you might pay special attention to that for those of you who have children, especially adult children. Stop with the advice giving. When I was teaching, this poor mom came to see me, and single mom with a jerk as a 15-year-old son. He was a real jerk. And mom was holding down two jobs and raising him, and I think there was another couple kids. Parent-teacher's night, she comes in, and she comes in exhausted. So we just talked a little bit. And, of course, she's worried about her kids. Worry. We'll get back to worry. And she keeps nagging and nagging and nagging and nagging. That's what my kids tell me. I nag them all the time. And I said, do you? And she said, I'm just trying to help. And I said, I recognize you. I have a mother just like you. Can I give you a little feedback? She said, sure. I said, I stopped listening to my mother when I was 12 years old, so she just started shouting louder, and it just got worse. I said, you could just stop talking to your children, and you'll get along with them much better. She thought I was kidding. It's already such a mess. Let it be. Ask God for help. Now, worry. I used to think that worry was taking action. I also used to think that worry was intimacy. If I was really worried about you, we're very close. Can't eat, can't sleep, I'm so worried, we must be very close. And it was the proof of friendship, it was the proof of all kinds of things. And what I've discovered as an older person is worry doesn't help anybody. And when I'm in my right mind, I do not worry. And I do not see it. Worry is taking positive action. I see it as wasting energy I don't have. Sometimes, for those of us who worry, we pray. Have you ever prayed like this? Oh God, everything's a big mess. I know you don't understand it. And so I'm going to explain it to you. And then I'm going to tell you how to solve it. Because I want you to do this and do that and do that. And that's my prayer. May I suggest that that's not a very effective prayer? Sometimes a perfectly appropriate prayer is just the word, help. One of my friends was a single mom with no resources at all and a lot of trouble and woe, newly sober. And she said all she could do in the morning, the only prayer she could make was, help me, help me, help me, help me, help me. And after a while in the evening, she was able to say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And that was her prayer for a long time. That kind of prayer opens doors. One of my sisters-in-law is from a different religious tradition than mine. She has a wonderful imagination. And we talk about things. And she thinks outside my box. I mean, it's very helpful to talk to someone who's from a different background, because you can see sometimes differently, and that can again save lives. And she, one of the prayers that she would do, she visualized the higher power as light. And then she would take the person she was worried about in the palms of her hands and hold them in the light. Visualize this. She wouldn't use any words. Well, I use that prayer sometimes. Tomorrow night's the first night of Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah. And the first prayer for the first night of Hanukkah is, O God, your first commandment was, let there be light. And then it says some more things, but I like that. Light coming into a darkened world, a violent, darkened, cold world. Bring light. I cannot fix me. And I sure can't fix you. Al-Anon slogans. I do some election work. I didn't this last election, but I like being involved in the community. My dad was involved in the community on a couple of things, so I'm one of those people that gets ballots and sets up the precinct and runs the precinct, and at the end of the day brings all the stuff in. I've been doing that for 20 or 25 years, and you meet the neighbors, and it's a way of participating in the city, and I like being the inspector. A bit of control and power. And in 92, my election board, we were in a senior citizen center in Oakland, right near the Grand Lake Theater, and a number of the seniors needed some assistance, which I'm happy to do. And some had trouble with their writing or their vision, and I would help out and help out. But you become pretty attuned to older people. I was there for several elections. I'm there, and three others were there with me, the election board, and my board. One was very old, kept falling asleep. One was crazy, kept talking about the end of the world and judgment. Not very helpful. And the third had a disability and couldn't use her hands to deal with paper, and she was smoking all the time. That was my election board. And we were using punch cards and chads and so forth. It was a long day. And usually in the course of that very, very long day, you take a break every couple of hours. You can go and get a cup of coffee or a sandwich, then come back. But it became clear to me I couldn't leave the precinct. Because, I mean, I really was the only competent person there. And this is a big deal. It's a presidential election. So I didn't eat. This is the hungry, angry. I didn't eat. I was angry. And I sure was, by about 4 p.m., I was dangerous. And more people are coming in. And this lady came in. She was a woman of a certain age. She hadn't been having a good day. And I don't think she'd been having a good day for about 20 years. And she came in and she snarled. That's how she began. I met her at the place. and she wanted her ballot. And there were a few other things. She was full of demands. And I've been there for about, 10 hours. And I haven't had lunch, and I have no blood sugar. And I'm done. And my first response, and this is the response of an untreated Al-Anon, is just to shove her down the stairs. It doesn't leave any marks. And if it's quick and no one sees, you know, old people fall down all the time. But instead, I used one of my favorite Al-Anon slogans, and the slogan is, I said to her, I'll be right back. And I backed off, because she was toxic. Capital T. And I was toxic, small t, ready to explode. Backed off, and I walked over to the, I breathed a little bit. There was some orange juice, and I got some orange juice. There was some blood sugar. I breathed, and I asked God for help. About 3 minutes off, little pause, then I came back, and I said to her, let's get your ballot. I live in a community in Oakland, and one of our, one of the brothers isn't as easy to live with as the others. And he will have little breakdowns and throw tantrums. He's only 62. And in the last one, it was something happened, and it makes no difference what it was. But he was just, he flew off the handle. And again, I noticed how close is he to the stairs. That's my, always my first check. And then I said to myself, I'll be right back. And I just backed away from him. As if from a hot flame. Because what I could have done is respond. And an awful lot of family misery is created not by the words used, but by the tone of voice that's used. And I had nothing good to say to him at that moment. And the next day, we connected and we could have a conversation. But the line in the book that was read at the start of the last section, I think is on page 133. It's a great line. It's from the family afterwards. And it says, first paragraph, avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. And sometimes in my recovery, when I'm miserable, I need to do an inventory. And it can be a real quick one. And I need to share that with somebody, and I have to look at what makes me miserable, and frequently it's my own bad behavior. So when the next election came around, well, let's go back to that one night. We had to take the precinct, the booths down, and I needed physically active people. And I called two of my sponsees, and I said, I really need your help. Are both of you sober? Yes. Well, come on over. And I had them help me clean up the precinct and take things down because I couldn't have done it by myself. And then I wrote a letter to the precinct board, to the Registrar of Voters, and I said, these three people aren't very helpful, just so you know. And I'm more than willing to help out, but we need people who are cooperative and helpful. And then I described each one, you know, and I said, so there. And I sent it. I had one lady come in, older lady, with her daughter, and the older lady was blind, and she said, I need help. And I said, sure, how can I help you with your ballot? And she said, her daughter was with her, and I said, your daughter can help you if you like. And she said, my daughter's a Democrat, and I don't trust her. And I said, let's not suggest family counseling here, but I can. And she gave you fill out her ballot, and you do what the voter wants, and you learn how to not overreact or scold the daughter, you know, or any of those things. So. Live and let live. Things take time. I want quick responses and quick answers. And some things take a long time. I remember it, I've been up to Yosemite a couple of times, and John Muir will say, if you want to see the face of God, come to Yosemite. And in the 19th century, a number of American landscape artists really believed they were painting the face of God when they planted the prairies and the mountains and the deserts. Wonderful to see thinking like that. Al-Anon slogan, keep it simple. My brain can be tied in knots, and I can think in equations, you know, like if this, if that, if this, if that, then you're wasting your time. If there's more than one if, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But I can get very anxious about the future. But I want to keep it simple. I can overdo a lot of things. I want to keep it simple. My tendency is to be very busy all the time. My folks got married in 1934. They ran off to Las Vegas. Got married on a Friday, and they were both back at work on Monday because they both had jobs. 1934. And one of the things I picked up was good people work. Better people work more. So whenever I felt ashamed or guilty or stupid, I worked more. And I had that all mixed up with being busy too. If I'm always busy, no one can criticize me. And one of my ways of being crazy is to be so overly busy and so overly tired that I'm pathetic. And there's no joy anywhere. I have to learn how to rest in recovery and enjoy things in recovery and have a good time in recovery. Work, love, play. Back to that description by Leonard the Shrink. Keep it simple. Easy does it. See, I think I could force it. There's a great Peanuts cartoon. Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown, and Lucy says, how many times does 5 go into 3? And Charlie Brown says, 5 doesn't go into 3. And Lucy says, it does if you push. And there are some things I just can't push. To back off. To let it be. Let things take time. Ask God for help. First things first. Well, that's dumb. If I'd known that, I wouldn't have to go to meetings, you know. But first things are recovery. If I'm not in recovery, nothing's possible. First things first. Some things are very important and some things are not important. And I've learned this some with age. And also you learn this some with losses. In the late 80s, when AIDS first came through the community, you'd see someone on Monday, they looked okay, and the next Monday they were dead. Boom! there were some very jumpy Narcotics Anonymous meetings around town. And some very jumpy AA meetings around town. And people full of fear and anxiety, and you started learning that we have today. Today. And some things are real important, and some things aren't important at all. And I've learned this. There's been some hard lessons. One of my friends was Peggy. Peggy was a nurse from New York. Peggy was tough. Peggy was an organizer. If the nurses ever wanted to elect someone to negotiate with management, Peggy got elected. She was fearless. And she fought for her patients, and she was she didn't even weigh 100 pounds, but she was one of the great souls. Peggy wanted the hospital to have an AIDS ward. Peggy was in recovery. And the hospital didn't want to, because what would people say if people with AIDS were in the hospital? I mean, this is... It's how we thought, late 80s. And Peggy got the AIDS ward going. And then the nurses went out on strike for some other reason, and Peggy led them, and it's all very exciting. Anyway, Peggy got sick by a stab of the needle. And she did die of HIV because of a needle stab. When the AIDS ward was full, it had been going a short time, and Peggy paid attention to her patients, and she found out that more than half of them were Catholic. So she went right to her desk and called the Archbishop of San Francisco. And she said, "Archbishop, this is Peggy so-and-so. A lot of your people are down here. I think you should show up." And he was there the next day. So Peggy called me. And she was pretty sick. And I'd seen her, but it had been a couple of months. She was real sick. "Tom, can you come see me?" And I said, "I'm so busy." And I opened my calendar, and this was a Tuesday. And I said, "Peggy, I can be there Saturday." Well, she is dead, of course, by Thursday. First things first. And what I have to remember is people are first. Not all the other crap I had on my calendar. Well, I'm supposed to, cut the lawn and change the tires on the car. If you have a sick friend or family member who calls and says, "Please, can you see me?" go see them. And I've learned that lesson. First things first means people come first. And some relationships come first. And it's more important than a lot of other stuff. My dad always had the job come first. And I value that, and I think that's frequently important, but people come first. I've learned that in Al-Anon. What I've also learned in Al-Anon is, this is an associated question, how important is it? Some things are not important. When you've experienced some sickness and some loss and some death, this is life teaching you that. Some things aren't important at all, and we can just let go. In Al-Anon, we detach with love. And that means we don't have to get sucked into the crazy. It aches. If someone you love is in trauma, you want to do what you can. The hard fact is, a lot of times there's not a lot we can do. Some people work real hard at being sick and crazy. And they get to. And they get to. We talk about one day at a time. Because this is what's real. For those of us who worry, there's a lot to worry about, I pay special attention to the disappearing glaciers. The glaciers are disappearing, the polar bears are drowning, now what, And then the world is ending, of course. What a relief, it would... It would be just fine with me. But someone has pointed out that the Mayan calendar is a circle. And that means it keeps going. Oh no, December 31st, now what? January 1st. But the day at a time is to be here, you know, this 7th of December, Pearl Harbor Day, the day before Hanukkah, the first Friday of the first week of Advent. Northern Hemisphere, end of fall, beginning of winter, Las Vegas conference, present, here, now. And it is in the present that we experience a power greater than ourselves. The breathing in and the breathing out, which is the experience of living things. One day at a time. Now, I can be a little bleak on that. I sometimes tell people, especially if I'm off and the days are long and I'm surrounded by fools, I'll say, you know, I've learned to dread one day at a time. I just dread today. I don't have to dread tomorrow. And I don't have to worry about tomorrow. I just worry today like a dog worries a bone. And I stay focused in the present and nothing's right. That works for me. Anger is a big part of Al-Anon too. A lot of us are angry. You get angry when your needs aren't met. And if you love alcoholics and addicts, there's a lot of needs that don't get met. Someone, they wrote an essay, and in the essay said that in alcoholic families, crazy families, drama takes the place of where the love used to be. And in some of our families, there's an awful lot of drama. Emergency rooms, police, firemen, helicopters. Day at a time. I don't always know I'm angry. I mentioned it once. Well, I'm so angry, I said. And someone responded, well, if you were really spiritual, you wouldn't be angry. And I said, that's so helpful. I get angry. And the program tells me what to do with the anger. I've got to do something, ask God for help. But when I'm mad, I go garden. I yank things out of the ground. I bury things. I dig things. I chop things. I vacuum. When I'm really mad, I can vacuum. It's a physical energy, and I want it to take... But then I can take a look at what makes me mad. And sometimes it's grief because it's loss, because something has disappeared or fallen away. In Al-Anon, sometimes we talk about the rage. We had a meeting once in Oakland, big day in Al-Anon, and we wanted to talk about being angry. But it's not polite, and people don't like being, you know, not being polite. So we entitled it something like anger or anger management, something. Anyway, the person who shared, the woman that shared the meeting, talked about wanting to kill a lot of people. Just shoot them dead. She said, not to wound them, just to kill them. She said, I don't want to punish them. I just want them dead. And it was so fun that we just laughed our heads off. And you start laughing about the dark side of recovery, you know. And so the next year, we were going to do it again, but instead of giving it an anodyne, sweet, syrupy, kind of friendly name, we entitled the session, What Would You Do With the Body? Now, my suspicion in this is Agatha Christie was from a crazy family. And as a little girl, she plotted perfect murders. And as an adult, she wrote those down. The perfect murder, you know. Well, that room was full of people. And it was amazing the lengths to which people would go because they didn't know what else to do. Because they were so isolated and so angry and so hurt, and they did not know they could share this with others and learn how to live and make friends. In AA, we say, we don't drink today. I was told, you can always drink tomorrow, just don't drink today. That's worked for me for a while. In my Al-Anon home group, the phrase was, you can always push them down the stairs tomorrow. We don't push anyone down the stairs today. And one of my pals on his desk, he just has the word tomorrow. And the people in his house think that he's singing songs to Annie, you know, but no, it's... Their lives have been spared many a time because of that one little sign, tomorrow. Let go and let God. Let go and let God. It is something I believe that God is at work. I think God is active. I think God is busy in a lot of places. And we can use our imagination and our ideas and our words to understand that. But even when I'm not looking, God is at work. And I sometimes have to allow God the space and time to be at work, even with me. Especially with me. Blanche said this is an Al-Anon prayer. She learned this as a little girl. Someone said, oh God, heal what needs healing and reveal what needs revealing. And then she said, then duck. Because stuff's going to happen. I can change my thinking. I need to learn some new things in recovery. I have to let go of some old ideas. Old ideas don't go away just because they're old or stupid or half-baked. I have to go out and actively recruit some good new ideas, and that's frequently a good reason to get to some meetings. Just to hear something new and to get to some meetings out of town and to go to a conference because you might hear something there that the people in your room haven't thought about yet. Some new ideas, some new thinking. Attitudes. Some of us have chips on our shoulders. Some of us are full of woe. Some of us are full of rage. We could use some new attitudes. A different way of looking at things. And behavior. In my early recovery, I thought I'd try one new thing a day. I can't tell you how crazy that made me. It's exhausting. Even one new thing a week is a lot. But a couple of new things a year aren't bad. And one of the things I started doing in recovery was coming to a complete stop at a stoplight. Complete stop. Letting pedestrians cross in walkways. Which means I need to be awake to notice that. Speed limit. Seat belt. Check tires. Check brakes. This was very new behavior for me. And I had to do it with my car, which I've had for a while. And I have to do it with me. And I have to regularly ask God's help for the people I work with and live with. Keeping my big mouth shut. Minding my own business. I'm going to end with the story I've used for the last several years about alcoholism, and it's the story of the gorilla. And I heard this and was able to expand on it a little bit over the years, but you talk about alcoholism, and Dr. Silkworth talks about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. I think that's a really good description. Dr. Jelinek has stuff out on the progression of the disease of alcoholism. It's good to know about that stuff too. What happens to the brain, what happens to the liver, what happens to all kinds of body parts. Those are all good things to know. But a lot of times alcoholism is like dancing with a gorilla. When I first heard that story, they didn't say dancing. They said dating. And they didn't say dating. But alcoholism is like dancing with the gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. I mean, that's the key. It's the law, the lack of power and the crazy. Even if you're taller than the gorilla, even if you're smarter than the gorilla, even if you're faster than the gorilla, once the gorilla gets his arms around you, the gorilla's in charge. And it kills a lot of people. They get mad. Casualty rates are oh so high. Not just among addicts and alcoholics, but among people who love addicts and alcoholics. The casualty rates are oh so high. Now, if you're clean and sober today, it means the gorilla let go. It doesn't mean you've outsmarted it. It's just taking a little nap. If the gorilla has let go, get out of the cage. And don't go back into the cage even when the gorilla starts humming your song, which it does. Oh, I'll never do that again. It was so humiliating. It was so disgusting. It was in all the papers with the police and the goats. I'm so ashamed. You know, never going to do that again. And then it's, you know, 2 years later and the moon is full and you hear music. One of my Las Vegas pals says, I don't want to dance with the gorilla. I just want to pet it a little bit. You know, just a little pet. Boom, you're back in the cage. Footnote, I don't know whether you've seen the current movie Flight with Denzel Washington. It counts for 3 meetings. Counts for 3 meetings. And you do see this remarkable thing, this brilliant, talented man who is one of us. And there's a scene where there's a little airplane bottle of booze and he grabs it. Back in the cage. Now, we who love alcoholics visit the zoo a lot. I like zoos. I've been to the San Diego Zoo, the Wild Animal Kingdom. I love giraffes. I love just watching them move. And I was in I was in Myanmar this past October. I went with 2 friends of mine to the zoo in Rangoon, Myanmar. Let me tell you, it was amazing. And there were gorillas there and snakes and stuff. A lot of crocodiles. Interesting. They had a sign in English and in Burmese. and there's a lot of crocodiles in there, and this, and they're all asleep, right? And the sign says, "Do not climb in. They are not sleeping. They are waiting for you." Thought about that. Well, you go by the gorilla cage and you see the person you love dancing with a gorilla and you go crazy. You've talked about this. You've warned them about this. You've heard about this. They've seen the movie. You've done so many things to make sure they wouldn't be back in the cage, and there they are again. And it might be your partner, your spouse, might be your mom or your dad. Heartbreaking. It might be one of your kids or your grandkids. You just go wild and you react. And you want to do something. And so you get into the cage. And you start vacuuming and sweeping and moving the furniture around and hanging inspiring little slogans on the wall and, you know, burn incense. Maybe that'll calm them down. Make nice, nutritious meals. None of that helps. So then you get between the gorilla and the person you love, and you try to separate them, and the gorilla turns on you and yanks your arms and legs off. One more casualty. So we have a program too. And it's called Al-Anon. And a lot of the Al-Anon program comes down to stay out of the cage. I'm just going into vacuum. We know. We know. We know, and because I just can't stand the mess. Yeah. We're meeting over by the giraffes. And we're going to talk about our vacuuming needs. And we're staying out of the gorilla cage for today. You could always go vacuum tomorrow. We're just not going to do it today, and we're going to rebuild our lives. It's hard loving anyone. It's hard loving alcoholics and addicts. There's always great pain involved, and exhaustion and anger and hope and recovery and grace and God. And friends, companions, and allies. And it's a whole new world. So there.